Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast. This is going to be a great show. We're talking about food safety with a veteran of the quick service business. Quick service is fast food to you and me, and it's something that almost everyone in the developed world consumes on a regular basis. So it's an amazing area if you're a technologist to focus on. You want your technology in the hands of huge business that has masses of product and customers, and then QSR is a great area to focus. It's something that I have done throughout my career, and there's a lot to learn about it. Obviously, we all know what a hamburger is, but you lift up the covers, and the operations and the technology behind the scenes are very significant. And so Rick Butner is stepping out from the time that he's worked in the orbit of Subway and IPC, which is a supplier consortium that's part of the Subway ecosystem. And he's focusing on the FDA's FSMA 204 regulation, the rule that everyone that's involved in food has to comply with. And he spent a lot of time thinking about it and preparing for it in one of the biggest food businesses in the world. So he knows a lot. He's also part of the GS1 Food Safety Modernization Act 204 working group, which I've had the pleasure of joining myself. And I can tell you that he is an insider in that respect. He knows a lot of the vendors. So do tune in. He's also a very interesting guy. I hope you stay to hear his music choices at the end of the show. Great show about food. We all eat about technology that many of us are either selling or implementing, and a critical driver for food and technology coming together, which is FSMA. Hope you enjoy it.
The Mr. Beacon Ambient IoT podcast is sponsored by Wiliot, bringing intelligence to every single thing.
Well, Rick, welcome to the podcast. It's a real pleasure and a privilege to have you on. You've got a ton of experience in this area that we're focusing on, QSR, quick service restaurants. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show.
So we'll spend some time defining what QSR is and the food services business in a minute. But essentially fast food restaurants. Ever since I started focusing on technology in retail, I've become a huge advocate and enthusiast about QSR. And my wife was saying, why QSR? Why are you talking about QSR on an IoT podcast? But, it's a bit like music. If we were a band, if Rick, you and I started a band, we'd probably have a lot of fun. But the fun really starts if people are listening and using, engaging with you. And if you can get a hit, then it becomes meaningful. You can change things, influence things. And the reality is, certainly here in America, I think the stat is like one in three people will go to a quick service restaurant during the week. Oh, that's what I read. Maybe you have better data on that, Rick. But we all shop, we all eat, And what better way as technologists who want to have people use our stuff than looking at QSR? And I think QSR is all about scale and efficiency, you know, beyond, I mean, you care about efficiency in everything, but you're dealing with huge volumes and your operational staff are young and pretty inexperienced. And I often look back at my early days at McDonald's when I was a teenager as being the closest to joining the military. You know, you take this raggedy crew and you deliver a quality experience at scale. And, you know, the reality is, even during World War II, only 10% of America served in the armed forces, but one in three of the population work in a QSR. So it's shaping us as consumers. It's shaping us as workers. So I think it's very significant, and the link with technology is strong. Rick, you're an expert in this area. I'm going to ask you about your background again, just briefly, but any comments on what I've said? Do you want to disagree with or amplify anything that I've said just now?
No, I completely agree. In fact, I even saw an ad by McDonald's, like 1 in 8 people, you know, that's their first job is working at a McDonald's. And if you take the entire QSR industry, that number's got to be close to 50% of the, you know, kids that start out getting a job, do it in a QSR of one shape or fashion. And the industry is very dynamic. It is one that doesn't change easily, though, because of what you said. They're so regimented and they're so focused on their brand and their products and doing things the way they've always done it, that change isn't easy in most QSRs. I can't say all, because some of them do change and adapt, but a lot of them don't. So I think that's what makes it so ripe for technology. I think it really needs technology.
As I was saying in the intro, you've got a ton of experience. You've worked as a manager of a store, of restaurants. You've worked at Subway, at IPC. So I want to use this time with you to cover three things. One is let's get the audience up to speed on QSR. Let's define it and explain a little bit about how it works, because even though we all use it, or most of us use it, a lot of people don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I do want to talk about the technology, and I want to talk about food safety, FSMA 204. You've been very active in that area, and I think we both agree that this is a catalyst for driving change and technology into this massive industry that is everywhere. You know, every town pretty much has some kind of QSR, even the smallest town will probably have a Subway in it. So let's start off with how do you define QSR? What is QSR?
Well, it stands for quick serve restaurant, and generally it's a restaurant that you go into that has a focus, whether it's chicken, whether it's hamburgers, whether it's sandwiches, pizza. They have a specialty, and their menus tend to be somewhat limited, but their goal is to get you in and out quickly. That's the quick serve. And they're focused on doing a lot of customers in a day. They're not happy with somebody that you know, turning a table every hour. They're wanting to turn hundreds of people through a restaurant within an hour if they can. So simplicity, efficiency is key to their operations. Very repeatable, easy to teach, easy to train new employees. And generally in the QSR industry, we have about a 250% turnover in the course of a year, maybe even higher in some. So you are training people all the time. That's why you have to have simplicity and ease of training. And the difference between what they call fast casual and QSR is fast casual, like a Panera, for instance, will have a much broader menu. They want people to come in and stay and hang out and get, you know, a sandwich and or bowl of soup and stick around and have dessert and maybe coffee later. And so they're not as interested in getting people in and out quickly as your typical QSR.
So there's some very obvious candidates for that category: the Subway, McDonald's, Burger King, KFC, all of those. What about Starbucks? Is Starbucks a QSR or is it a fast casual?
I think Starbucks is more a QSR.
I agree.
They want to get people in and out. And another thing most QSRs have done is done a very good job of developing a mobile app.
Yes.
So they can get orders ahead of time and they don't even have to greet the customer. They come in, they grab it, and they go.
Yeah.
So Starbucks fits that category, I think.
And drive-thru is a huge part of their business, which seems to be another attribute of QSRs as well. Although obviously the pandemic and all that sort of stuff, there's more a kind of omni-channel thing for the fast casual folks. And I was surprised that increasingly drive-through can be the biggest part of a QSR's business, right?
Oh, absolutely. You look at Chick-fil-A and some of them you look at, they have 3 drive-through lanes, you know, and they're busy all day long. I mean, it's really kind of mind-numbing to see how many people go through their drive-throughs in a day. But yes, drive-through is usually a high percentage of their business.
It's such a huge market, and we consume so much of it. It seems like, well, this is like printing money, but it turns out that it's actually pretty hard to run these operations. And I want to talk about one thing that is sort of like the strength and the weakness of QSR, which is the franchise model. And it seems like franchising and QSR, that goes hand in hand as well. I know there are some operations that don't. I think like, what is it? White Castle is wholly owned. The original quick service restaurant, arguably, is White Castle, made famous by the movie. And then there's like In-N-Out and so forth. But generally, am I right in saying that franchising is a big part of that business?
It is. And, you know, the world I came from at Subway, we were 100% franchised. There was no company-owned restaurants. And I think a lot of brands over the past decade have gone away from corporate ownership to franchising. And they keep a small portion of restaurants as company restaurants so they can go in and play and do whatever they want to do. But they find it more profitable to franchise because you don't have the real estate, you don't have the building upkeep and the equipment upkeep and all this that goes into owning a restaurant. So they're freeing up capital to do other things. So they're going to franchise.
So what if I want to open up a QSR? And I don't want to start from scratch. How much does it cost me to buy a license, QSR license, and what do I get for my money?
That really varies brand to brand. I mean, it's very wide. We used to say that for Subway, you can open, I forget what it was, 6 or 7 Subways for the cost of opening 1 McDonald's. So it really varies, and the services that they provide vary, but generally the brand has to be able to enable the franchisee to operate their restaurant the way that the brand wants it operated. That's the basic bottom line premise of of being a franchisee. The brand has to provide you the tools. They'll provide you the know-how, and maybe, you know, this is where you buy the equipment, this is what you need to do, and here's training materials for your staff, and others get much more involved. But it's there's a wide range.
It can be hundreds of thousands of dollars, though, right, to buy.
It can be, yes. Yeah.
And the flip side of that, which, you know, in trying to sell technology to QSLs, the pushback that I've received is, well, you know, we don't actually own the restaurants. And so this technology seems great, but we can't just tell the operators what they do in every aspect of the business. And clearly this is a it varies type answer as well, right? But your experience is, I guess, deepest at Subway. And I remember certainly, you know, quite a few years ago, there was a lot of fragmentation of the point of sale platforms, and McDonald's was like one of the first. When I worked in McDonald's, it was in 1979, and we were using the same software platform that they were using in Dallas, Texas. You know, it was amazing, and that was, I think, in an era where a lot of people had mechanical point of sales. They were pressing levers, and there were bells going off as the cash drawer shot out. The whole order management and inventory was being driven. But now I think it's increasingly, is that part of the package? Like, if I was to buy a Subway franchise, would they tell me, here's where you get your point of sale devices, and they all are using the same software release for the point of sale system?
Yes, they are. Yeah, they've come a long way in that regard. And I think you kind of hit on it a little bit. For QSRs, I think their focus on technology that they've invested in has been focusing on tools that will enhance the customer experience, whether it be POS systems, digital menu boards, mobile apps. That's where their investments have focused on, because as you said, they will come back and say, I don't own the brand, I don't own the supply chain, I don't, you know, that's not my realm of responsibility. From day to day, what I do is I ring up sales and greet customers and try to make their experience the best possible. So that's where I think you'll see a lot of QSRs have invested money. And I think almost to the exclusion of investing in supply chain technologies. Supply chain technologies are kind of the last frontier when it comes to QSRs, in my opinion.
So if I'm running a QSR, can I buy my product from, who do I buy my product from? This is probably
they will tell you.
Yeah,
they will tell you, this is a product you have to buy, and you have to buy it in your area. This is your distributor, and open an account with this distributor, and they'll tell you what days you're going to get your orders.
So you used to work for IPC. This is probably a good case study. Can you explain a bit about who IPC is and how they relate to Subway and its franchisees?
IPC was started in 1996. You know, Subway's been around since 1965. So it was, you know, it got into the game when there were probably 15,000 restaurants. And now in North America, IPC services, about 25,000 restaurants. But IPC is a franchisee-owned purchasing cooperative. And that model's not unusual in the QSR industry. Quite a few other brands have purchasing cooperatives. And our role was to, Subway would still give us specs for the product. They were required to approve suppliers and the products that they produced. But our job was to optimize the supply chain to get it to the restaurants as efficiently and cheaply as possible, so that they could, you know, have lower food costs. So that was basically the model of IPC. The franchisees are their members. They are their members, but they also are their owners. So there's been a franchisee board of directors, which include a few other people now, but yeah, that's kind of the model for a purchasing cooperative. It's very franchisee focused. It has to have a good relationship with the brand. Can't operate outside the brand, but it's there to drive efficiencies for the franchisees.
So in terms of a source of technology for the franchisees, then potentially that cooperative is providing technology as well as delivering buns and lettuce and that sort of thing, I assume.
Yes. I mean, I can't speak for all of them, but at Subway, we had developed a in-restaurant inventory management tool that IPC licensed for all the franchisees to use free of charge. And that tool was initially for taking inventory, but then it evolved into receiving your inventory, your deliveries in. It could do that automatically so that the restaurant manager didn't have to keep punch them in to their to the POS. It also turned into our ordering platform. All of our restaurants would order through that tool as well. So yes, there are technology tools that supply chain teams and or purchasing cooperatives can help develop to help franchisees operate more efficiently.
Very good. Well, there's so much to talk about, but I think just having a little bit of a wallow in all of the technology that is being used, you touched on a number of the technology trends and deliverables a little bit earlier in our conversation, but this podcast is about IoT, and really we started primarily on Bluetooth beacons, and of course Bluetooth beacons have been deployed in quick service restaurants fairly extensively, although not as much as I was expecting. And probably one of the most notable deployments is by McDonald's, and I believe they use Radius Networks devices. You see these table tents, and they end up on the tables. And increasingly, I remember when I worked at a QSR, it was, I think, the 14th McDonald's in the entire United Kingdom. And so people in England hadn't been trained on what to do in a fast food place. So people would sit at the table and start shouting us as we stood behind the counter saying, when's the person coming to take my order? And where's the cutlery? And why are the portions so small of these things that you're calling French fries that I call chips? And it was quite bizarre at first, but now, it's second nature to every teenager in the United Kingdom what to do in a McDonald's or a Subway or... But and obviously that process flows differently in different categories of QSR, but it seems now that it seems like QSRs are trying to eliminate the order taking, and they're focusing on the delivery. And if they have to go to your table to do it, then they'll do it. Or I guess they'd prefer you to come up and pick it up yourself. So that seems to be one area of figuring out where the customer is sometimes a desirable thing. Having technology to look at who's in the drive-in queue and what order they ended up is another area. Can you speak to any other major kind of deployments of what might be called Internet of Things technology in fast food that you think is notable, or just technology in general?
Yeah, I think one that's pretty notable and I think very valuable is temperature monitoring. That is something that a lot of QSRs do and do it very effectively.
In the supply chain for the food?
Well, even in the restaurant, once it's there, somebody could prop a cooler door open and get called up front and they never close it. And eventually it's going to send an alarm off to people that, you know, can see it on their phone. You know, so I think temperature monitoring within the restaurant is a very good use of IoT.
You said on their phone. So is, you know, we're all used to the McDonald's app, the Subway app, but is there another app? That to what extent do store managers and workers have an app these days? Because that's a key element, I think.
I think a lot of restaurants do have apps. They might have a iPad that they use in the restaurant as sort of their, it's really more of an operations app. Mm-hmm. It tells them, okay, it's time to take temperatures. Okay, it's time to, you know, whatever, mop the floor, clean the bathrooms, whatever. It gives them the whole list of things that they're supposed to do throughout the day. And it is kind of their operations manager. But a lot of those IoT devices feed into that, where it says, you know, check the cooler, the temperature of the cooler. It's fine. Check the temperature of the cooler on the back line. It's fine. You know, so IoT devices in those environments makes it easier for them and more reliable, quite frankly, for them to go in and record the temperatures. Because it's amazing when you have the old, chart on a clipboard, man, every day that cooler is 34 degrees. And it never varies from 34 degrees because people just think that's the answer that they need to put there. So they don't bother checking it probably, and they just put 34 degrees. I think there are other uses for IoT devices also that you can hook them up to measure the efficiency of your equipment. How many times does your compressor cycle on and off? Is it getting to the point where it's doing it too often and costing you money, and you'd be better off paying for a service call to get it cleaned and checked out, and rather than having your whole cooler or freezer go down and waste all the food that's in there. So there are opportunities for devices to do that. And then once again, that can go to your operations program, whether it's on a tablet or an iPhone or whatever, so that you can, you know, maintain your equipment more efficiently.
Very good. Well, let's talk a bit about supply chain and the opportunity there. You know, what are your thoughts on the state of the art for managing supply chain? If that's the new frontier, where are we, and where do you think this needs to go? And how does the new FDA rule? I mean, it's actually been a work. It's been developed over many, many years. So it's for some people,
correct,
it's not, but it's now the law of the land, and we have until January the 20th, 2026, to comply.
Correct.
And on the other side of that, there's potentially civil criminal penalties for not complying, and certainly huge reputational risk because. Whilst some people will probably be late, other people won't. And so how's that going to make people look? So tell us a bit, but FSMA 204, as we call it for short, is not the only thing that's happening in supply chain. What is the current state of the art in terms of managing supply chains, would you say, and where are the opportunities there?
Let me just go back and touch on FSMA 204 first, if I could.
Okay.
You know, I think there's three general views right now on FSMA 204. One are brands that are attempting to meet it now. They're going out, they're exploring new technology, whether it be IoT devices, RFID devices, relying on barcodes for scanning. They're exploring their opportunities and what will work for them. And I think if they haven't been working in this arena at all, I think they're finding it to be very challenging. There's no easy button. They're not going to get there overnight. They're not just going to tell all their suppliers, you have to put this barcode or this RFID tag or this IoT tag on every single case, and it has to include this information. That does not happen overnight in this world. Many of their supply chain partners will have, they're like, well, that's a technology request. We can get to it in maybe a year, year and a half. Yeah, because you know, no company, whether it's in the food service industry or outside, I don't think any company has enough, technology resources to do everything they want to do. So everybody always has to prioritize a list. And if it's something for just one customer, that's going to be pushed down the priority list. So it's not going to be as easy as they think. The other view is they're thinking about it. Yeah, we know the law's there. We know we're going to have to comply at some point. That's 2026. Yeah, it's only 2023. We got time. So they haven't even started looking. And then there are others that I think are firmly banking on the hope that the compliance date's going to be pushed out because it is so hard. So they're the procrastinators. They're the ones that are really pushing back and going, yeah, we'll see if they really do anything about compliance. Because compliance, yeah, what the penalty is going to be hasn't really been clearly defined.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, they might be the ones to say, you know, I'll take a risk and I'll do it after everyone else is doing it because then adoption's going to be easy. But I really do not agree with that. Because I think one thing that's got to change in this industry is we have to approach FSMA 204 as an industry and not as individual brands. If we don't all ask our suppliers, our redistributors, our distributors to do the same thing, nothing's going to get done. We have to have some basic guidelines. I mean, you think back to EDI. I don't know if you're familiar with EDI documentation. Okay.
Well, we should spell it out a little bit. But yes, personally, advanced shipping notices,
electronic
all that sort of stuff.
Data interchange. Right. But every single brand has their own version of what a EDI 856 is, an ASN. And they all want a little different information. There's no standard anymore. It was supposed to be standardized, but it's really not.
So for people that aren't familiar with EDI, we should just take a moment and explain a bit about what electronic data interchange is, just kind of the complete novice explanation.
I mean, it was designed to be a way for companies to exchange information, whether it's something as simple as a PO and an invoice in a standardized format, and to do it electronically so it was more efficient, didn't rely on somebody key punching it in. You could do it electronically and the data would flow through into your system and it would satisfy your needs for whatever data you're looking for. Like I said, there's a lot of different ones. There's POs, there's advanced shipping notices, there's load tenders, there's ASNs, there's,
But there isn't actually a fully GS1 FSMA 204 compliant EDI standard. It's certainly mentioned in the recommendations, and this, one of the electronic documents that is exchanged from a distribution center and a store can be an advanced shipping notice, which is basically kind of a list of this is what I'm going to send you. But it doesn't necessarily have all of the, to use the FSMA FDA terminology, the key data elements, the source ID and so forth may not be in there. So we can't just say, oh, well, we use EDI, problem solved. And keep me honest here, is that
correct?
Yeah.
No, that's exactly right. Exactly right. And in the case of a distributor to a restaurant, just because a case was intended to go to restaurant number one on the route, it is all up to the driver when it gets to restaurant number one, if he picks that case off or he picks another case off.
Right.
And that becomes a real challenge in things where you have pallet-loaded items like your French fries from McDonald's. They don't pack those on a truck by restaurant stop. They stop. They put whole pallets of product on a truck. So as it gets to the restaurant, that's when it needs to record what actually was delivered, because there might be three different lock codes of French fries on that truck that day.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So FSMA 204, there's these critical tracking events that you have to capture accurately. Can't just say this is what we think and then of course stuff happens. You actually need to know, which either means you've got someone with a clipboard that's writing it down and then entering it into some sort of electronic system so that you can get the data to the FDA within 24 hours of their request, or you have some auto ID automatic way of either ambient IoT, IoT pixels, full disclosure, that's what my company sells, RFID, or handheld scanners, and you've actually got someone who's at the restaurant who's doing the scanning, and the other kind of critical tracking event is receiving. So just saying I shipped it, to your point, is not enough. You need to know what was received. And that is, obviously every restaurant wants to know what they've got. But, I think it's a fairly common scenario that the driver shows up and maybe he's in the middle of nowhere and there's no one at the restaurant at 3 a.m. So you need to have some kind of system that actually makes sure that what is being put in, the lettuce that's being put in the cooler is the batch that came from Farm A rather than from Farm B, that came in on day one rather than day two from a given farm. So the net is you need to have a whole level of receiving and just asking the driver to check his own homework and scribble his signature is probably not going to pass muster. Again, keep me honest that here, Rick.
Correct. But one thing I think that is, you mentioned GS1 before.
Yes.
And I think that is the crucial step number one in anything we're trying to do here. If we're not all talking the same language for the same product across our supply chain, then it doesn't matter the data that's collected at each point because no one will ever make sense of it all. So starting with GS1 standards and requiring the use of a G10, the use of a global location number across your entire supply chain is essential. And we did that at Subway. We joined the GS1 Food Service Initiative. We were one of the founding members in 2010. And we started requiring a global trade ID number, a G10, for every single product. And we didn't tell a manufacturer you have to change your number. We didn't tell a distributor that you have to change your product code number. And quite frankly, Subway didn't change theirs. They still had their own product number. But we said, add another field, and this is the G10 for Subway Turkey.
And the reason why that's important is that it has to be consistent, right? All the way from the point of origin where the product was packed or notionally created. You can't, the kind of by de facto, you have different players and they identify the products differently. But if it's the same thing, you basically have to have that consistent traceability lock code, which in GS1 standard parlance would probably be a GTIN, the global trade identification number. So that's the thing that changes, isn't it? It's like you got to have consistency so that someone gets sick in Enterprise, Oregon. You can then go back and say, well, I know what the GTIN is that is part of that traceability lock code, and I know what the lot number is, and I know that that lot number was produced on this day at this farm in Washington. And it can't be a different one. You can't be trying to do the math to correlate it. And that's where the process change goes in. And I don't know, do you think... So Subway did that. Do you think that's correct, the state of the art everywhere, or is there a...
I think it generally is now. Okay. Most brands have adopted GS1 standards, which is great, because without them, you need an army of people to map data. And once again, you involve humans, and we all know that that can be something that's challenging. But the other thing that you really need as step number two is an automated data aggregation system, because you're going to be getting data from hundreds and maybe even thousands of different sources, suppliers, distributors, redistributors, restaurants that either scan a barcode, you know, read an RFID tag, you know, read a Bluetooth IoT device, whatever it is, that's creating data. And you have to capture it. You have to capture it automatically. And you need somebody or some organization or some tool that's going to aggregate all that data into one file that can be searchable. And that way, when you're looking for Subway Turkey, and I, you know, don't want to just say Subway, but if you're looking for Turkey with this G10, and you have a lock code, you can then go into this database and put in that G10 and the lock code you're looking for, and it can spit out everybody that has scanned or read that lock code into their system. So data aggregation is a huge, huge part of it. So we, once again, when I was at IPC, recently retired from IPC, looking to do any kind of consulting work in this arena at all to help brands prepare for FSMA 204. But we had a data aggregation company many, many years ago. It was FoodLogic, that's now TrustWell. There's several out there that can do that type of work very, very efficiently. But that's a key. That is absolutely a key to being able to comply with the FSMA regulations. So you're collecting all the right data, and then you're having someone aggregate it into one system so that you can use it efficiently. That's kind of the basis for everything. Then the last step is figuring out what tool you're going to rely on. What technology are you going to rely on? And I know a lot of people are still looking to rely on scanning barcodes. And it can work. It can work. But there's many risks involved. And they are at every step of the supply chain. Number one, are the barcodes reliable? Number two, in distribution, are you going to have someone that's selecting those orders that absolutely scans a barcode on each individual case? Are they going to get there and say, okay, I need five cases of this, scan one barcode five times, and off they go? And then in the restaurants, are we going to have somebody that scans every single barcode that comes in the back door? So I think from my point of view, automation is what has to happen to truly meet the FSMA regulations. I think we have to get to a point of automating that data collection.
Well, I totally agree. And in many ways, I think we've both personally placed some bets on this. You've moved from IPC, a very long, illustrious career there, working and scaling one of the biggest supply chain operations for one of the largest quick service restaurant businesses in the world. And you've focused on this, and now you've chosen this time to consult more broadly with this entire industry that's having to meet the deadline. And Williot, we decided that you can use IoT pixels for anything, these Bluetooth tracking devices. But I believe that food safety is not only a good business, it's a kind of a worthwhile thing to focus on. Keeping people from getting sick is good. And then from a business perspective, I think not just for Rick Butner and Steve Statler at Williot, I think for every QSR chain, getting supply chain automated, which is really what's required to comply, is a huge opportunity for profit, for reducing waste, for driving down the capital requirements in your supply chain, to optimizing store operations, staffing, dealing with, it's a chance to do some more automation so that these raw recruits we have working for us can do a better job. So yeah, it's a pain. You've got to comply. It's the law. There's going to be penalties. There's reputational risk. But there's, I believe, a huge ROI when you look across staffing, inventory levels, waste reduction, food quality, freshness, taste. There's just a massive opportunity if people start to apply the 21st century technology to their supply chain. So yeah, congratulations. You've got an amazing point of sale system and you've got kiosks in the front, but let's focus on the food.
Right. No, I completely agree with you. And we did a proof of concept on that very thing in 25 restaurants. And that's exactly what we found, that we identified opportunities where distributors were delivering product with short shelf life. We identified opportunities where operators within the restaurant weren't rotating their stock properly, which led to product going to waste. We saw opportunities for them to be able to take more accurate inventories, and that led to more accurate ordering. And in the future with AI, that's going to lead to not only suggestive ordering, but predictive ordering. And you're going to have restaurant managers that won't even have to place an order. The system's just going to know what they need, but it all is reliant on collecting accurate data from the time that product gets in the door until it leaves. The other thing that was really beneficial for our supply planning team was to see how long it took them to get through a case of product in a restaurant. What was the turn rate within the restaurant? And when you're dealing with promotional items, that's something you're never really sure of. But they could see it very clearly in these restaurants. Oh, it took them 8 days to get through a case of product. Now I can really hone in my forecast and make sure we have enough product to get through the promotion, but not too much. So that gets back to your supply chain visibility. You have a lot more visibility into what the supply chain needs. It also helps to have visibility of lot codes at distributors. Many times we would, expedite cut a PO because we thought a DC was heavy in inventory, but we couldn't see the expiration dates on that product. In truth, they ordered more because they knew that some of that product was going to be expired and they couldn't ship it. So they ordered more so they'd have it to sell to our restaurants. And that was, we probably shouldn't have cut the POs. But anyway, a lot of efficiencies all the way through the supply chain. That's what's going to be gained. And you're right. I think the benefits and the profits will far outweigh the cost of implementing any system.
Just to chip in here, I had always thought that for my day job, we have case level temperature tracking, and I always thought that tracking that en route in transit would be one of the last things that happened, because you think about the number of delivery vehicles that exist, there's a huge number of them. But that's actually not the case. We're seeing one of the largest retailers in the world preparing to put Bluetooth readers in every refrigerated container to measure the temperature at a case level. I actually just got back from grocery shop, the trade show this week, and we had someone driving around Las Vegas, an Uber driver, to sort of illustrate the point. We put half a dozen of these tags, and I don't normally do this, I'm kind of feeling bad, but it was just so cool. I gotta share it. So we had half a dozen of these temperature sensing IoT Pixel devices in basically the four corners of the middle of this cab, and a heat map, and you could see the Uber driver, and we had a little webcam so you could see them going through the car wash, and I was amazed that they were all different temperatures, and that's just in an Uber. So think about a refrigerated container and the temperature map there all over the place, and it's borne out in the real world of food delivery. We were seeing like strawberries for one of our customers being frozen and defrosted 6 times between the DC and the store. So you wonder why the shelf life is not good and people complain with what they get when they're home. So if you can identify that, fix it, get a message to one of these apps, then that's better quality, better taste, less waste. And then suddenly you've got a system that is pushing data to the whatever the application is, Trustwell, iFood DS, IBM, FoodLogic, whatever right. It is, iTrade Network. No one justifies, oh, we got to spend money on an accounting system now. Everyone accepts, oh, yeah, I need ERP. Well, I think people need the applications that, by the way, we don't sell those applications. So they need the applications that give them the dashboards that allow them to get visibility and see when things are going wrong and press the button when the FDA calls so that they don't have to throw away every bit of lettuce in the entire supply chain, and they just purge the things that are impacted by these events that we're forced to deal with that are not going to go away. Well, sorry I interrupted you. We should probably wind up. We've been talking for a while, but any other key things about FSMA that, if I'm a If I'm the CEO, CXO, SVP of operations at a quick service restaurant, you know, what should I be doing to get ready for FSMA 204?
Well, like I said, it's, you know, starting with your data, starting with how you collect and aggregate your data, but then you really ought to be doing proof of concept tests with the various tools and what you think is going to work best in your environment. Is it RFID? Is it, you know, Wiliot IoT devices? You know, you need to get out and use it in the real world. And then you have to start looking at some of your key suppliers and how will they implement. Because it's not easy. You know, there's a lot of different ways that you can do it. Tagging in many, many different ways. Are you tagging at time of actual production? Are you tagging as you're palletizing? Are you tagging whatever? You have to look at those opportunities. When are you going to put these devices on the cases? And how important is it to read every single device off of every pallet all the time? Or are you going to rely on a pallet tag? So there's a lot of things you need to start looking at as far as how you're going to implement. And the only way to do that is to get into a manufacturing plant and try different things. What's going to work? And then you can take that model and move forward. But I do think as an industry, it is key that we as quick service restaurant operators all start asking for basically the same thing. Because if we're all asking for something different, we don't have a prayer of everybody being able to meet FSMA 204 by January
20th, 2026. Yeah. I totally agree.
In a lot of arenas, these brands never play together. But this is one that we have to come together as an industry and do what's best for the industry.
Very good. And there's profits to be made. There's margins to be saved, to be increased as well. Well, Rick, it's been a real pleasure talking. We should check in again in a bit and see what you're seeing. But I think you've chosen a really good time to plow your own furrow and apply some of the expertise you've gathered over decades. Because I think people need help, and actually getting some help from the outside is useful, because you can say things sometimes as a consultant that you couldn't say when you're talking to your boss. So that objectivity and also kind of a set of eyes that are seeing things across different businesses is really valuable. So thanks very much. Rick, I like the look of the artwork behind you. What is that? Seems very tasteful.
That's an artist we found over in Bel Air, Florida, that we really like. And kind of abstract. She uses, you know, various colors and gold in it. And, you know, we really like it. This one she framed in a very old antique frame that we very carefully hung, because I think if I move it, it's going to fall apart. But we love it. It's sitting here in our dining room, and that was the best spot for lighting and visibility, I think. So it gets a place behind me here. So,
well, as you know, we have this warm-up question that gets cut and paste to the end of the show, which is, what three songs are meaningful to you and why? And I've asked this well over 100 times, and only once has someone said, actually, I don't like music, but I do like art. And so we ended up talking about the three paintings that are meaningful to him. So are you in that category, or do you like music?
I absolutely adore music. Love music. In fact, in my house, you know, Friday night was always, there was never a TV on. It was always music.
Awesome.
All kinds, from, you know, rock to jazz to country to, you know, even Christian now. So it's all kinds of music. And this was probably the hardest question on the whole interview list here for me, to pick the three favorite songs. Two came very easily, and one was a bit of a challenge to narrow it down to three.
All right, well,
probably should have given you a top 10 list, but
yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, and truth be told, if people aren't aware, there's a show called Desert Island Discs. It's the longest running radio show in the world, and they get eight. But given that we have less time to devote, then I cut it down to three, which makes it harder for you. But so what is your number one?
Well, my number one, my all-time favorite song is really Hotel California by the Eagles. And as I was a young man, I guess, I was definitely out of college at that point, but that was my favorite album. Absolutely my favorite album of all time. It just has so many good songs on it. The Last Resort, Life in the Fast Lane, Victim of Love, Wasted Time. I mean, it's just song after song was fantastic. And there's really nothing about the lyrics of Hotel California. It's just whenever it comes on, you know, I'm happy. You know, that's kind of my happy place song. I love it. I know every word. I can, you know, I think I can play the air drums pretty well to it, but that is my favorite song.
I think if you were to list, you know, greatest albums ever, that would obviously be somewhere up there along with Sgt. Pepper, Bridge Over Troubled Water. So there's a set of just Pet Sounds. I agree. And I remember, it's evocative for me. I remember listening to it as a kid. In a very rainy suburb of London, thinking how amazing it would be to end up in California, and that's where I live now. So, I don't want to appropriate your song, but good choice.
Okay, number two for me is "Stairway to Heaven," and I think that comes from a couple places. First of all, I just love the way they start with the blues and mellow, and then they ramp it up a little bit, and then they really get into the rock at the end of the song. And I love the artistry of it. And then there's words in there that have had meaning to me as well. There are two paths you can go by, but in the long run, there's still time to change the road you're on. So I think that's always important to keep in mind, that, you know, just because you're going down this one path, there's opportunities. Don't be don't be afraid of trying them. So that's meant something to me through the course of my life.
Yeah, that's another great choice. And I've started, you may see there's a vinyl turntable behind me. It's a Riga Planar 3, if anyone's into audio equipment, but I've found myself going to Walmart actually to buy vinyl. Walmart is a great source of quality vinyl, and I've been buying a whole bunch of Led Zeppelin vinyl to play on that thing. But very cool. I agree with your number two. What's number three?
Well, number three is a song that means a lot to me now. It's, you know, I'm a Christian, and part of my journey was getting to it through music. And it's I Can Only Imagine by Mercy Me. And the whole story of the song is, you know, what will it be like when I first see Jesus? You know, after I die, I go to heaven. What will I do when I first see Jesus? And that song's just had a lot of meaning to me, and has really helped me in my Christian walk.
That's amazing. That's very cool.
And it was also a very good movie. If you haven't seen the movie, It was a very good movie.
Please do send us a link. We'll publish it because that wasn't on my list. But do send us a link and we'll include it in the show notes along with the other two, which I think everyone won't have any trouble finding. How did music help you in your path to Christianity?
Well, I think it just helped deepen my path. You know, I had been going to church really all my life, but really didn't fully grasp what it meant and what I should be focusing on and what I should be doing. So as I got into a community down here in Miami 15, 16 years ago, and they really got me kind of turned on to some Christian music and started listening to it more and more. And just the messages within the music really helped deepen my understanding of what it truly means to be a Christian and to have a closer and deeper belief in Jesus.
Makes sense. Yeah, there's obviously music has played a big role in many faiths, not all of them, but many of them. And I think a lot of us experience some kind of transcendence that maybe helps you open your mind to, you know, beyond the mundane everyday things that we get caught up in. So I think it's there for a reason, isn't it? Very good. Well, thank you for that, Rick. How did you get into the quick service business, quick service restaurant business?
It was my very first job when I was 16 years old. I started working at Hardee's and worked up to, that was my junior year in high school. My senior year, I became an assistant manager, a night manager there. And every summer when I came home from college, they took me back on as a fill-in manager so they could get vacations. So it was kind of in my blood from a very early age. When I got out of college, I worked on Wall Street for a little over 3 years and found myself not really happy in anything I was doing in Wall Street. And then I went by and they had moved me to Fort Lauderdale to open a new branch. And when I driving by, I saw them building another Hardee's. I said, you know, maybe I'll get back into this for a little while and see where it takes me. And 40 years later, I'm still in food service. So I've had a lot of different roles in food service, not just running restaurants and multiple restaurants, multiple concept, facilities such as travel plazas and things like that, but I've gotten out of the operations side into more the operations, the supply chain operations side. And I helped build a brand. I helped establish food safety and quality department at Subway, and then I transferred to the supply chain team and focused on supply chain operations. How can we make things more efficient? And it really ties all the way back to restaurant operations. You always look for efficiencies and how you can make it better. And that's what I've been doing for the past 40 years.
Very good. Well, Rick, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And we've really just started the conversation. So thanks very much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, that was Rick Butner, who never ceases to amaze me, the stories that people have and how much you learn about people from talking to them about music, which is why I do it. Hope you enjoyed that last bit of the show. I want to thank Aaron Hammock, who is our editor and produces the product that you've either watched or listened to. Also want to thank Brooke, who is our marketing specialist that's focusing on getting the word out about this. And I want to thank you most of all for listening. It certainly doesn't escape us that we only get to do this when you listen or watch. So if you've got to this stage, then you're truly a committed and dedicated listener, and we really appreciate you. Do review us if you would. It really helps us get the word out and allows us to continue doing the work that we do. Speak to you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.